Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 31st, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Courthouse Steps teleform conference call on the Supreme Court's decision this morning in U.S. Army Corps of Engineers v. Hawks Company. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert and returning teleforum guest, Mark Miller. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for his presentation of about 10 minutes, followed by your questions. And with that, Mark, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Will. So for the listeners who are new to the case, I'll just give you a thumbnail sketch, a background of this case. This case is called U.S. Army Corps of Engineers versus Hawks Company, and it was 15-290, and the U.S. Supreme Court decided today unanimously to rule in favor of Hawks Company, which was Pacific Legal Foundation's client. I am a second chair on the case with Reed Hopper, who was first chair. Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit organization that represents landowners and other individuals pro bono. And so in this case, we got involved at the Eighth Circuit level. And so let me tell you a little bit about the case, and then I'll talk about the opinion. So for background, for more than 40 years, landowners really have had no meaningful way to challenge a wrongful application of the Clean Water Act to their land. And that changed today when the unanimous U.S. Supreme Court ruled that landowners have the right to challenge federal claims of jurisdiction in a court of law. The Clean Water Act authorizes the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate, quote-unquote, navigable waters, which these agencies interpret to mean virtually all waters in the United States and much of the land. Such waters, quote-unquote, are subject to complete federal control. They can't be disturbed without a federal permit. This puts landowners at the mercy of the federal government. In this case, a family-owned business in Minnesota known as the Hawks Company sought to harvest peat moss for landscaping, and they were going to be harvesting it from peat bogs that were nearby other properties where they were harvesting peat. The Corps claimed jurisdiction over the property as federally regulated wetlands, even though a Corps reviewing officer, when Hawks Company administratively appealed that decision, even though that reviewing officer had found that there was no federal jurisdiction over the land. He had found the JD, as we call it in the parlance, to be erroneous. Nevertheless, when he reversed the JD and said, no, Army Corps, you don't have jurisdiction here, the Corps said, yes, we do. And so at that point, Hawks and the family that owns the Hawks Company was in basically an impossible position. And really all landowners who were in that similar place are in an impossible position. They can either abandon the use of the land at a great loss. They can alternatively seek a federal permit, which in this case, the Corps had let them know they were going to openly opposed to, and spend a couple hundred thousand dollars trying to get that permit that, of course, the Corps had made clear they didn't want them to get. Or they could have proceeded in the face of the jurisdictional determination without federal approval, rolling the dice that the Corps would be wrong, that if the Corps went after them for discharging into what the Corps said was federally controlled wetlands, and they went to court at that point, that they would get a judge to say, after they were being fined to the tune of $37,500 a day, and facing potential criminal prosecution, that at that point they can get a judge to say, no, this is not federal wetlands, Corps, you don't have jurisdiction. Well, Hawks Company didn't want to do any of those three things. They rather wanted to simply go into court immediately, not discharge, not seek a permit, and not just abandon the land. Instead, they wanted to go to court and have a judge review the administrative record and say, yes, the administrative appellate official in the Corps was correct. There was no jurisdiction here. Or no, the Corps is right. You're going to have to get a permit. But they wanted their day in court. But the problem was that since the Clean Water Act's inception, every court to have considered this matter, including the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, had held that landowners did not have the right to contest core jurisdiction. That was true even if the landowner could prove the core was wrong. For 40 years, the core had had the power to federalize any parcel of land with standing or flowing water without any real accountability. As my colleague Reed Harper has said, and Reed was the first chair on the case who argued Hawks, and of course savoring his victory, and he also argued Rapanos about a decade ago, is, as he said, it's hard to conceive a regulatory regime with greater potential for abuse. But we won at the Eighth Circuit, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers petitioned the Supreme Court for review and to accept review of the case. And interestingly, and I have to think was unusually, we, on behalf of Hawks Company, agreed and said, yes, U.S. Supreme Court, you should take the case for review because you need to create a national rule here. And one of the reasons, of course, we were zealously representing our client's interests here. We thought that the court would take the case. But at the same time, we had a companion case at the Fifth Circuit that we had taken a petition up on called Bell Company. And then Kent Recycling at the Supreme Court, because there was a couple of litigants at the Fifth Circuit. We had taken a petition up just a few months before the court took theirs up. And from the Hawks decision, we had taken our petition up in the Fifth Circuit. The court had denied it. We then moved for rehearing because the denial came right before the Eighth Circuit made a conflicting decision with the Bell Company case. And so we took the position of we asked for rehearing and said there's now a circuit split. The Corps then sat on Bell Company while Hawks, after the court accepted Hawks. And so Bell Company, we expect, I don't think I've seen it, but Bell Company will be granted, vacated, and remanded, and the Fifth will be told they were wrong. So anyway, we argued that the court should take the case to set a nationwide precedent that would benefit all landowners, public and private. And today the court upheld the Eighth Circuit decision, granting landowners their day in court to challenge federal overreaching under the Clean Water Act. We would call this a long-awaited victory for property rights, fundamental fairness, and the rule of law. So that's sort of a thumbnail sketch of the case and how we got to today. We had oral argument in the case on March 30th. We were optimistic after the oral argument that we had a good chance of success here. The questioning was very interesting, and some of the questioning clearly leads into the opinions we got today. As I said earlier, the case was decided unanimously, but there are a number of opinions. There's a majority decision for seven of the justices, and then Ginsburg concurred in the result. We had walked out of the court that day thinking that our best day was going to be 7-1 with Justice Kagan as the dissenter, but in fact, she signed on to the majority opinion. And so let me get into the opinions. So Chief Justice Roberts wrote for seven justices, and of course, Justice Ginsburg concurred in that result. Justice Kennedy wrote concurrence on behalf of himself, Justice Alito, and Justice Thomas. Justice Kagan wrote for herself in a concurrence, and Justice Ginsburg wrote her own concurrence. Roberts said that he felt that a jurisdictional determination, and writing for the court, the seven justices felt that this was a case that met the Bennett versus Speer two prongs analysis that gets you into court from an administrative decision, in the sense that it was a final decision, and from that final decision, legal consequence flowed. He explained how even the agencies themselves call the jurisdictional determination final, and said that the agency couldn't even argue that a negative, what we call a negative JD, which means the agency, the Corps, has said that your property doesn't contain federal wetlands. The agency had admitted that that was final because you have 5 years to then use your land without fear that the agency will turn around and prosecute you. And since that negative JD clearly had legal consequence, the other side of the coin, a positive JD, if you will, as we have here, also had legal consequence, also was final. And then, of course, legal consequences flow. This part of this decision, I think, is very important for all litigators who litigate against federal agencies, because his point here was that like other precedents where the court has said, when you look for legal consequence, we're not looking for angels dancing on the head of a pin. We're not looking for necessarily what happened in Sackett, even though Sackett did sit legal consequence, where the Sackett, which is a precedent case we won 4 years ago, guessing many of the people on the call know that decision. The Sacketts were facing a compliance order from the EPA telling them to fix up their property that they were cleaning up because the EPA considered them to have disturbed wetlands. And so they were looking at fines of $37,500 a day or double that if they didn't immediately clean up their property and stop pushing the dirt around because the EPA said it was wetland, federal wetlands, and they didn't have a permit. In that case, the court had said unanimously that that was a legal consequence, that that astronomical fine of $37,500 a day or twice that was a legal consequence. Here, Hawk's company wasn't facing fines. They just simply couldn't do anything. If they went forward and used the property without the permit, they were looking at criminal prosecution and fines, or they had to spend money to get a permit. Or they could do nothing. But in any event, they were looking at practical consequences. There was the JD clearly had consequence. It was hard to believe that anyone could argue it didn't. And in fact, stepping back a little to when we were presenting the case, it was so hard to believe that anyone could say we didn't that, unsurprisingly, nobody filed amicus briefs supporting the government's position here. There was almost, if I remember correctly, 16 amicus briefs representing 60 different either groups, states, some public agencies that are not federal, everyone saying NFIB, Chamber of Commerce, everyone saying that clearly this has legal consequence, this has practical consequence. And Justice Chief Justice Roberts said, yes, I agree with that. There's really no argument that this is not, there's really no tenable argument. There's not practical consequences here. Then you had Justice Kennedy in what I think will probably become, not surprisingly since it's Justice Kennedy, one of the most interesting and picked over parts of this decision, his concurrence. At the oral argument, he remarked that the Clean Water Act might be unconstitutional, and many commentators had picked up on that and said they found that quite interesting that it was Justice Kennedy who said that because it was his concurrence in the Rapanos decision where he sort of muddied up, if you will, pun intended, the meaning of navigable waters when he said it would be waters that have a significant nexus to interstate waters. Arguably, it was Justice Kennedy who made the Clean Water Act so hard to understand and so ambiguous that it could arguably be unconstitutional. And in fact, here he was saying at the oral argument that the Clean Water Act may be unconstitutional, and many people tied that to his Rapanos concurrence. So here he has now written a concurrence where he does call into question whether the Clean Water Act, I want to make sure I say what he said. The act's reach is, quote unquote, notoriously unclear, as he quotes Justice Alito from Sackett, and the consequences to landowners, even for inadvertent violations, can be crushing. And so he says the reach and systemic consequences of the Clean Water Act remain a cause for concern. In light of, as I'm sure many of the callers know, in light of the ongoing Waters of the United States litigation, I would think that his concurrence here is going to become, it's going to make the Clean Water Act, the Waters litigation challenging last year's new interpretation of Waters of the United States, even more interesting. And I think that his concurrence may become a feature of that litigation. Then you had Justice Kagan. Justice Kagan concurred, like I said, surprised us. She concurred to say that the fact that the two agencies at issue here, it was the Army Corps of Engineers that makes the JD determination, but it's the EPA that also at times will make a jurisdictional determination. And there is an agreement between those two agencies that the EPA would consider itself bound by Army Corps of Engineer JDs. The Solicitor General's office had argued in court that this agreement, this memorandum of agreement from the late 80s, in fact, only applied to special cases, but by its own terms, that was obviously untrue and was really the wrong note for the Solicitor General to start off with at oral argument, and Chief Justice Roberts gave him a hard time about it because he just simply read from it. And so Kagan wrote to say that it was her feeling that the memorandum of agreement is why she signed on, that because the EPA considered itself bound by the JD, this was a decision that had legal consequence. And so what she's implying there is that if the two agencies simply decide to tear up the memorandum of agreement, that maybe she then wouldn't find the a JD to be appealable to federal court. Thankfully, she wrote that only for herself. There's no way to think, after you read these opinions, and particularly after you read the after having seen the oral argument, that a majority of the court would agree with her on that. And she obviously wrote for herself here. Although Chief Justice Roberts talks about the memorandum of agreement in his majority opinion, I don't think he's saying it was a predicate to their decision. It's rather, I suspect, a bone he was throwing her to get her to sign on to the majority. And then finally, you have Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg wrote a sole concurrence for herself I think Sotomayor may have joined with her in the Sackett case, where she said she thought the Sackett case was simple. The Sackett case was about a final compliance order that was clearly final, and it had legal consequence because fines were immediately imposed by way of it. And if you just read her concurrence in Sackett plainly, you would have thought her vote here was pretty simple too. And in fact, it turns out, at least if you read her concurrence, it seems it was, because she just simply says she thinks that a JD is final and it has obvious consequence, and this is a no-brainer. The memorandum of agreement between the two agencies has nothing to do with the finality or the consequence angle from her perspective. Simply put, a JD is final, consequences flow, you can appeal. Really, it would seem to me no different than what she said in Sackett for the most part, at least in my initial readings. So I think TLF is very excited, and certainly Kevin Pierce, the principal owner of Hawks Company, and his family, the Pierce family, very excited with this outcome. It does seem like a case that will redound to the benefit of other individuals and property owners who want to push back against federal government overreach because of its interpretation of the Bennett versus Speer test and its, the way it uses Abbott. And then another case, an old precedent called Frozen Food from the 50s. I think this case opens the door not just to Hawks Company getting into court earlier in the administrative process, but to other litigants who want to push back against federal overreach. So with that, I'll turn the floor back over to Will.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for that those helpful remarks. We're going to open the floor to audience questions now. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, and just to repeat, if you want to ask a question, please enter star and then the pound key, and we'll put you right on with our expert, Mark Miller. While we wait to see who might ring in with a question, I want to make a quick commercial announcement here. Our next scheduled telephone conference call will be Friday at 1 p.m. We're going to be speaking to Professor Eugene Volokh about new ABA model rules of conduct and some free speech issues that are bound up with that. We do have one question on the line right now. We'll go to that caller. If at any point you decide that you want to ask your question, we invite you to do so by hitting star and then the pound key. Let's take our first caller.
Thank you. Chip Power, Bastown, Charleston, West Virginia. Was wondering if the court's opinion addresses the exhaustion of administrative remedies in the situation of Hawking Company today, would they still have to pursue the Gore's administrative appeal route as the Hawking Company did?
Mark, were you able to pick that out?
Yeah, Will, could you try and repeat it? I could hear parts.
Yeah, I didn't get that much of that. Caller, are you on speakerphone or in a very noisy place? We couldn't quite understand what you were saying.
I'm on a mobile. Is this better?
Only slightly.
Well, let me try. What I heard was...
Is this better?
Yes, that's better.
Yeah, I was just asking whether or not the court's opinion addresses the need for exhaustion of administrative remedies, whether the Hawks Company or others in that situation would have to still pursue the administrative appeal route before seeking federal judicial relief.
Well, I think that, on the front end, the Hawks Company had pursued an administrative appeal challenging the JD, and the Corps had said, the official who did that administrative review had said that no, you have not proven up, Corps, you've not proven up that their property is subject to federal, has a substantial nexus, a significant nexus to interstate wetlands, so to navigable water. So at that point, they had exhausted that administrative appeal. They couldn't go any further. So the question, I guess what you're saying, I think, is do they, should they have had to then pursue the permit? That's really the federal government felt that was giving them, that if Hawks Company had not exhausted its remedies because they could pursue getting the permit. And then once the permit was denied, say after they've spent $100,000, as Chief Justice Roberts points out, at least, and the permit's denied, then they can appeal. And that's a adequate alternative to appealing now when they wanted to. And so what this opinion is saying is, no, that's not an adequate alternative. That in fact, once you get that final decision, legal consequences flow. You don't have to continue jumping through hoops that the federal government has created to challenge the predicate decision, which is that there's federal wetlands. Because once they've decided there's federal wetlands, the jig is up, basically. It's now simply I analogize it a little bit to the Nolan situation, in that they now can tell you how high you have to jump, and it's a kind of extortion. They're like, well, if you want your permit, you're going to have to do X, Y, or Z, because we say you have federal wetlands on your property. And so we're saying, no, we don't think we do, and we should get to go to court to have a neutral magistrate make that decision. So effectively, the decision is saying, yes, you have to take that administrative appeal that the I would think it's saying, it isn't said explicitly, but certainly implicitly, yes, you have to take that administrative appeal that the Corps and the EPA have created to implement the Clean Water Act. But no, you don't then have to pursue the permit, that once you've got that JD decision, you can challenge it. Is that responsive?
That helps. I was curious as to whether they could have gone straight to federal court without pursuing the administrative appeal of the adverse JD.
Well, I don't, Chief Justice Roberts, I don't think, at least in my quick couple of reviews of it so far today, I don't think he addressed that explicitly, although I will point out that it really helps their case that they did do it, because it makes the case even more noxious when you're in front of the judges and you say, look, even the court itself recognizes one, the right hand recognizes the left hand is wrong. And so when you're the standard review we're going to get when we get into court is arbitrary and capricious. And so when you can say that the court itself has officials that don't think they've proven up, they have jurisdiction, it helps to make that arbitrary and capricious review stick, that it is arbitrary and capricious. If the court itself, if the right hand is saying to the left hand, no, you haven't proven up that you have jurisdiction, and then the left hand says to the right hand, well, we don't care, we're just going to go forward anyway. So what happened here, and interestingly, is also what happened in Bell Company, what became known as Kent Recycling at the Supreme Court. In both instances, when the administrative appellate review was sought, the Corps official doing the administrative appellate review said, no, JD has not been proven up. But the agency then stuck with it anyway. So although, you bring up an interesting point, that it may be something to consider down the road as to whether it's worth it to move the goalposts back there. I'm not going to comment on that, but it is an interesting idea whether to now try and push further and say that you should get to review, you should get to go to court immediately. It did help the case, it seems to me, at least in presenting the case, that for the court and then for the Solicitor General representing the court to say this is not final. Well, you know, as we posed it in moot courts and in oral argument, what other non-final decision, you know, that's at least not final as to of itself, do you get to take an appeal of, even if it's called an administrative appeal? You know, generally, you look for final decisions, even if it's non-final as to the case overall. You know, like when you seek cert in a state appellate level or a, you know, discovery order or whatever, it's always final as in and of itself. And so it made it much tougher for the agency to argue this was not final when they gave us, you know, when the agency itself gives appellate rights. It's just not appellate rights to go into federal court.
Well, we do have another question on the line now. We'll go to that caller. After this next caller, our line will be wide open. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star and then the pound key, and we'll be glad to put you on with Mark. Let's go to the next caller.
Hey, so I have kind of a two-part question, I guess. One is I think, a follow-up to the prior caller's question, which is sort of what happens now as a practical matter for Hawks as the plaintiff. And then the second part of that is the opinion seemed to place a lot of stress on this JD provision having all the, you know, this formality to it. What would happen if the Army Corps just got rid of that JD, you know, approval/review provision? So those are my questions.
So say it again. Say your first question again.
Sorry. The first question is, what happens now as a practical matter for Hawks? Do they go back to district court or what?
Right, exactly. They will go back to district court. In fact, they were in the district court and ramping up towards summary judgment. And they're going to be trying to show that, just as you would in any sort of administrative appeal to the district court, that the agency's decision was arbitrary and capricious. And we feel pretty strongly about that because, as I said, you know, the agency itself, the right hand said to the left hand, you haven't shown a significant nexus here. You haven't met the Rapanos test in either manner. They tried to meet it in the significant nexus. The Kennedy concurrence way. So that's what will happen next for them. And in fact, like I said, it was holding on a summary judgment motion, cross motions, when the court granted review. And so at that point, the district court stopped, obviously, moving forward to see what would happen here. And then, yes, the court definitely has said that, oh, gee, we could take away this favor we're doing for you, by, you know, we're doing you a favor by saying that we've got control of your property, and so now you'd just be flying blind. But our position at PLF has been all along is no, they're doing themselves a favor when they make those JD decisions, and they're not going to take that away. It's similar, they made the same sort of threat as to compliance orders in the Sackett case, and I haven't seen any evidence that they've stopped issuing compliance orders. And so similarly here, we wouldn't expect that they're just going to stop doing JDs, because it's helpful for them too to get out in front on the issue. And in fact, their own briefing showed us in the at the Supreme Court that there's just not a lot of cases that even get to this level, right? You know, usually the property owners will agree that there's federal wetlands, that there's the feds have jurisdiction. This is for the hard cases where the agency has gotten it wrong, and that's where the property owner most needs his rights protected, because they've gotten it wrong, and they should get, you know, somebody should be able to get relief when the government is wrong and when the property owner is sure they're wrong. And again, that sort of dovetails nicely with the Fifth Circuit case, because it's the same thing. In both cases that the Supreme Court has on this issue, you had landowners who had the court itself saying, on the one hand, yes, we've got control, and on the other hand, but we admit we haven't really proven it, but we don't care. And that's where you need to get, you know, judicial review. So bottom line is, we don't think that the agency would take this away, because it's the agency themselves who've made it confusing. If they simply would treat navigable water in the way that anyone on the street would think navigable water is, then you wouldn't need this complicated process to understand what the water of the United States. The problem is they want to enforce it for every ditch and puddle, and that's where the landowners don't know what to do. If they would interpret the law, the Clean Water Act, logically and plainly as it reads, and navigable water means navigable water, then you wouldn't need a JD. But it's the agency that created the problem, and so for them now to complain about the problem they created is sort of rich.
We did pick up one more questioner during that answer. We'll go to that caller now, and after that our lines will be wide open. We've got plenty of time to take more than just this one more question, though, so I invite you to hit star and the pound key at any point during this answer.
Well, thank you for a really excellent presentation and for all your work in this case. It's a thrill to see it come down unanimous this way. My question is, assume for a minute with me that the Army Corps is as intransigent as the IRS and as radical as the EPA, and that they may... People in there are going to want to dig in their heels and try to do something to limit the effects of this decision. Will they try to redefine waters of the U.S. with some other rulemaking process, or will they push in Congress for some change in the statutory language to try to get around this case? Will they try to push the decisions over to the EPA or somebody else to be the fall guy? Or how will they do to try to continue to expand their jurisdiction to every puddle and ditch that passes through anybody's land?
Well, not only can we guess that they will try and reinterpret waters of the United States, but we know they will. They did last year, and they are trying to push through a new definition of waters of the United States that the Corps and the EPA say fits, they would say flows, pun intended, from Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Rapanos. But in fact, many states and private litigants and Pacific Legal have pushed back and sued and said that the new definition of waters of the United States is a significant overreach and goes way beyond what the court approved in Rapanos. And I think that Justice Kennedy's concurrence here is a signal to the litigants in that in those ongoing cases. There's cases all over the country, the Sixth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, and some of the district courts, that they need to continue to push that. You've got three justices here saying explicitly they think the agencies are overreaching in terms of their interpretation of what waters of the United States is under the Clean Water Act. And although Chief Justice Roberts didn't sign on, I think anyone who does believe that the government is overreaching here is probably reasonably hopeful that Chief Justice Roberts would agree with that opinion, even if he didn't sign on to the concurrence. So it would reflect why President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland is so important. What would he decide if he was confirmed, or whoever the next justice is going to be? In terms of Congress trying to address the Clean Water Act, I think that the justices, have made it clear that they wish Congress would rewrite any number of laws to try and rein in agency overreach, and this the Clean Water Act is no different. But there doesn't seem to be much effort in Congress that's going to be successful anyway. There may be some effort on behalf of some senators and congressmen to try and fix the Clean Water Act, but I haven't heard of any significant, serious effort to try and rein in the way the Corps and EPA are interpreting waters of the United States. So it does seem it's going to be up to the courts, at least for now, And that's why, you know, PLF continues to push these cases. We represented Rapanos 10 years ago, and we, as I said, my first chair in here in Hawks argued Rapanos, and now here we are 10 years later. Even though this case is more of an Administrative Procedure Act case, obviously Rapanos is all over it, and Justice Kennedy, his concurrence reflects that he recognizes these two cases connect, have a significant nexus, if you will. And so we're going to see, I think, relatively soon what the majority of this current Supreme Court and perhaps a new ninth think about the way the agencies have redefined war as the United States. And this decision would suggest that all of the justices are sensitive to the idea of bureaucrat overreach, agency overreach.
Thank you.
We have one more questioner on the line. We'll go to that call, and I hope that we'll have another questioner after if someone hits star and the pound key with their question. Let's go to the next caller.
This is Warren Belmar, and you've started to address the concern that I had with respect to the role that Congress should play in providing a definition for waters of the United States. It doesn't require, I believe, a full amendment of the Clean Water Act to just add a definition. So my question, and it wouldn't be out of place for Congress to exercise its legislative power rather than to have everyone complain about how the agencies are exercising Congress's legislative power by coming up with definitions. But has anyone in a congressional effort proposed a definition of waters of the United States so as to have it decided in the Congress rather than leaving it for the agencies to, and then court deference to resolve the issue?
Well, actually, my understanding is that last year, Senator Heidi Heitkamp of, I think it's North Dakota, had introduced legislation that where she wanted, it was right after the new proposed rule on waters of the United States was issued by the EPA, and she was circulating a bill that was going to require the agencies to try again. And so that's probably the
I'm not talking about agencies trying again. Do we have a definition? Do you have a definition that you think would be appropriate for the Congress to enact? And if one put it forward to as a very narrow one-page piece of legislation, might it not have some way of letting the Congress resolve the issue rather than giving further direction to how the agencies might go about doing it?
Well, yes. If I was the sovereign, I would definitely – I could create a one-page rule, I think, that say navigable waters means navigable waters. And so I think that what you're proposing certainly would be doable for any senator or congressperson who wanted to take it on. Pacific Legal Foundation itself generally does not take on the writing of proposed legislation. I know a lot of organizations like Pacific Legal do that kind of thing, drafting, you know, proposed bills and the like. Pacific Legal does not. We're more litigators, and that's where we focus. But I think that's a great idea, and I think that it's an idea I may take back to PLF to suggest that we might want to make an exception. Because
or you might want to just have others take a look at what, if you were advocating to the court in litigation, the correct way to interpret the statute, and then just write the statute, the definition of the term, the way you think appropriate, share it with other groups, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Congress could act rather than complain about the inability of the agency to do its job. And it'd be very sad indeed if Congress can't provide a definition to a term that's this important because it's too complicated for it to handle, which strikes me.
And that's right. Yes.
It's a policy issue.
Yes, and I agree with you It seems that it's an issue that got away from Congress 40 years ago, and they've been more than happy, as is so much true, so often true when it comes to agency decision making, that they let the agencies, you know, make the tough decisions, and then they sort of wash their hands of it. We have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. As
Justice Scalia was finally having some concerns about the non-delegation doctrine. And
right.
This is an area where it may be a proper form of delegation to the agency, but that doesn't preclude the Congress from providing an answer rather than leaving it for interpretation or development by the agency. And,
you know, rather than punting, you know.
Exactly.
And, so I guess,
and it right. seems to me if you have that legislation as just one provision, definition of waters of the United States, all this litigation would be over.
From your lips. I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Well, now we got to find someone who wants to go forward with it. And I don't think it'd be that difficult.
You would think not, but I don't know how many people on the Hill there you're going to get to agree with you. I would agree with you. The navigable waters should not be hard to define. Waters of the United States, navigable waters should not be hard to define. But
well, if you come up with a definition and shared it with everyone on the call, I would be more than happy to try to organize a group to share it with all the relevant committees on the Hill, is just urging adoption of the one sentence definition.
Well, can you do me a favor and shoot me an email so that we can stay in touch? And
well,
your name was?
Warren Belmar.
Warren Belmar. Okay. All right. All right, Warren. I will. I'll shoot you an email so we can stay in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Big things happening on the call. We do have one more caller in line now. If you'd like to ask your question after this next caller, please hit star and the pound key.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS, and we're in the effort to build solar-powered mobility networks, and you can also see Hyperloop and other such networks. And this decision, I'd like to see if we can't expand this out around the post-roads restriction, which was voted into the Constitution on September 14, 1787, to restrict federal involvement in infrastructure, so that we can privately fund the construction of alternative transportation networks.
Okay. Any question?
How can we take and use this current decision to block federal funding for, like, mass transit projects that are competing with the networks? So, like, Amtrak and take the MBTA expansion, and they're looking at a big where these $100 million.
Well, I lost your signal there for a minute.
I think that we've lost the caller entirely, actually.
Okay.
Mr. James, if you're back on, I'm sorry that we cut off the second half of your question there. Hold on, looks like he's rejoining now. While we wait to try to reconnect that caller so he can finish his thought, if anyone else has a question, we are wide open right now. You can hit star and the pound key. Mr. James, if you're on again now, which it looks like you are, if you could hit star and the pound key, we'll give you back the floor to finish your thought. We were disconnected with you halfway through there.
Hi, this is Bill James. I don't know. I lost my call, so I'm back.
Okay.
So
your question was,
all this alternative networks have to have access similar. I think it's a lot like when the federal communications monopoly was recognized as unconstitutional in 1982, and it allowed long dormant innovations like the internet and cell phone networks to find niche markets and scale to commercial viability. Currently, the highway monopoly and the mass transit monopoly subsidizes ineffective and expensive things that are failing, in lieu of privately funded alternatives that will become the physical internet?
Well, I'm not sure how much this case would impact that. I think what I heard you say earlier was to try and stop federal funding. I don't think this is a case that you're going to be able to apply in that sort of way.
But
this is a case that more is going to apply in the sense of agencies making final decisions that have immediate practical consequence on you, where the agency say you're not able to get into court until much later in the process. And here,
well, let's take an example of the Boston Greenway expansion, where there an agency is allocating $1 billion. And could we use this to say, no, this should be a privately funded $100 million effort instead of $1 billion of taxpayer money?
Yeah, this doesn't really fit that. I've consulted with people on cases along those lines. This is not a case that's really going to fit that. This is a great outcome here for Hawks Company and for fighting back against agency overreach, but it's not a case that you're going to be able to use to apply, I don't think, to fighting federal funding for pet projects. That's going to be a different line of cases, not this one.
Now, if you have any interest in suing on them, love to talk to you about it.
Well, you know, I'm Mark Miller, Pacific Legal Foundation, and if you look at the, I know that Will sent my info, and so if you look there, you'll see my contact info, and definitely feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to talk to you.
Okay, because there's going to be a whole bunch of this with all these alternative networks that have been, that are in process of being built right now, and we're going to start building in China and India because we can't build in the U.S.
Okay. I'd be happy to talk to you offline.
Thanks.
All right, we probably have time for one final question here. If you'd like to ask a final question, I invite you to hit star and then the pound key. But seeing none, Mark, do you have any final thought you want to – well, we do have one more, actually. So we'll take that caller. This will be our last caller, and then we'll have a chance for a quick closing statement from Mark.
Hello. Oh, hello. I just have a quick question. I'm not an administrative lawyer, and so a lot of this is a bit over my head, but I just wanted to I know that agency deference is a big deal in the sense that it seems to me that there is, as a conservative and as a constitutionalist, that there's way too much of it given to these government agencies. And how do you look at what happened here today? I mean, I realize it's an APA-focused decision, so in a sense it's sort of narrow, but do you see this as a possible sign of, you know, reconsideration, this trend that's been kind of burgeoning of looking at deference and, you know, sort of how much latitude the agencies get and what the courts are willing to give them? Or is this just sort of, you know, this was a final decision and, you know, it's in one box and the facts were this way and you know, the lower courts had it another way, or what, you know, or other decisions went another way, and it's much more narrow. Do you see a sort of a larger implication, or how would you classify it in that regard in the sort of larger debate about administrative law?
I think it's a narrow decision in the sense that it doesn't implicate, say, Chevron deference, or because that's going to be more of a substantive, you know, they're going to defer to the agency's substantive decisions. I think there is a trend away from that. And I think you're right about that, our deference, Chevron deference. But here, it's more a matter of, you know, can you get to the courts in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So the courts can then apply those tests. And I'm with you, and I think PLS in general is with you in theory, that to push back against the Leviathan regulatory state, we need to get the courts to recede from the Chevron deference to our deference to really put some teeth into review over agency decision making. This is a good step in that direction in the sense that at least the courts are saying, yes, we do get to review. I mean, because, you know, even if they're going to defer, it's better that they at least consider whether to defer than that they not even get there. And so here we're saying at least, let's get into the courts. And so in that sense, what I think what the line of cases, the stack of cases, and now Hawks have to commend them, among other things, is that it's showing that the idea that the federal government may be overreaching isn't a liberal or conservative thing. Because again, in Sackett it was unanimous, and now here it's unanimous. So this is not something that breaks down on ideological lines. Rather, we should all have the right to our day in court. That's really what our country is supposed to be about. This isn't about the king telling us vassals what to do and us simply having to grin and bear it. And it's nice to see that both sides of the, you know, when we're living in a country right now where we're so fractured and everyone thinks the court is 4-4 on anything important, here, what is vitally important, which is the right to get into court, the court is in unanimous agreement that, yes, you should have the right to get into court. And so, although this case doesn't speak to Chevron deference directly and any pushing back of that test or our deference, nevertheless, it is certainly a step on the right path that Chevron, you know, pushing back against Chevron and Auer also would be on. Where, you know, an outcome the other way, I think the nice way to put it would be to flip this around. If we had lost this case, I think it would have been a real blow to the idea that the bureaucracy has gotten out of control. That the court would have been saying, nope, bureaucracy can do what it wants, and you all just stuck with it. And you have to wait and just keep jumping until the government says you don't have to jump anymore. And finally, you know, this line of cases that we've been able to nurse along to repeated success now at the Supreme Court level shows that the justices don't see the federal government, the executive agencies, as having the kind of power that they think they have. And so it's certainly a good sign for what you're asking about.
Well, let me just help me out with something. So you have sort of like Chevron deference about an issue, deference to, you know, sort of like a substantive policy making, right? And then, but there's a sort of this other side of the debate about, or this other kind of battleground, right, which is about who gets to define the extent of the agencies or the jurisdiction of the court to review things, right? And I mean, is this in that box, or is that even sort of a little bit? Is it still a little bit removed from that?
At least the way you framed it, I would say this is the court saying we get to decide.
Okay. Well, that's
so
very significant.
Yes, I would totally agree with you there. This is an important case. I'll leave it for other commentators to say how important, but I think we at PLF feel this is a very important case for the idea. And pointing out, you know, every prior precedent before Hawks, the court said, no, agencies get to do this, and you just have to deal with it and go through the permitting process, spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars before you can even find out whether you're going to get a permit or not. And if you want the permit, they can tell you to jump, and then once you get the permit, you're probably not going to want to challenge the JD because you've then now spent so much money to get that permit. And this is the court saying that, no, you should have your right to your day in court before you spend all that money and before all that time is spent fighting over that jurisdictional determination. In the time, you know, this case did not directly have a due process claim, but really what this is about due process. The APA, the APA, where it provides for judicial review, Section 704, is supposed to allow you to get into court. And the reason why the Congress put that in there in the 40s was to make sure you got your due process. And so here you had agencies saying, no, we don't have to give you fairness. We don't have to give you due process. And here's the court saying, you know, yes, you do. This is a no-brainer. And really what was, again, so nice about the oral argument and so nice about these opinions is to see all of the justices agree on that yes, property owners are entitled to fundamental fairness, and part of fundamental fairness is your right to your day in court.
Well, right, and one of the things I think that you pointed out a number of times here, though, but it is reassuring, is that when the agency loses basically, let's say, 7-1, right, or whatever, however you want to put this, 8-0,
yeah.
they've really sort of blown it, right? When they can't even get, you know, Breyer or somebody like this to, you know, I mean, when you can't get some of the liberals to really sort of, they're just kind of off the reservation in terms of what the courts will put up with, it looks like. So this was kind of, you know, I mean, for the agencies themselves, they sort of probably need to sit back, especially EPA.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to sit back, at least until the
end of
this.
I mean, right.
Until the end of this executive term, although I'll point out that the agencies have been overreaching. We're upon us since 2006, so it's not just this current administration. But certainly cases like Sackett and now Hawks would hopefully send a message to the agencies that they need to rein themselves in, and Rapanos too. They need to rein themselves in. The problem was what we saw with Rapanos is they were not they did not rein themselves in. Instead, last year, we got this even larger expansion of what war as the United States is supposed to mean. And that's why we have to push back. And this is the court saying to the agency, to the agencies, to the executive branch, yes, you've gone way too far. But whether, you know, the administration will actually take that seriously is, you know, it's another issue.
Well, thank you for all your great work.
Thank you, sir.
Well, we have time for a quick closing statement here, if you have a last word that you'd like to add, Mark.
Sure. Well, I guess I'll just, for those who are litigators who are on the line, I'm just going to invite everyone to focus on Kennedy's concurrence, because the victory for Hawks Company and the Pierce family is fantastic, and I think it's a pretty clear victory. But then we have something even more. We have Justice Kennedy inviting, effectively, litigants to push back against the way the Corps and the EPA have grossly expanded the Clean Water Act beyond what the Constitution would allow. And Kennedy and Alito and Thomas are inviting people to use, I think, their opinion to challenge the War as the United States rule and the Clean Water Act in general, enforcing the Clean Water Act in general. And so I just invite the litigators who are on the line to take that seriously. And I know PLF will be. And, you know, thank you, particularly to Federal Society. Thank you, Will, for inviting me to speak. And it's an honor.
Well, we're very pleased that you're able to find an hour to spend with us on what I'm sure is an extremely busy day for you. Congratulations on the outcome of the case. Thanks, everyone who joined in to the call and asked their questions. I hope that we'll hear from a lot of you on Friday as we discuss the ABA's some changes suggested to the model rules of conduct and some free speech issues there. That call is on Friday at 1, but until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.